This is Classical IPR, a service of Interlochen Center for the Arts.
Violinist Ergene Kang is a professor at the University of Arkansas and concertmaster of both the Fort Smith Symphony and the Arkansas Philharmonic Orchestra. For several summers, she also taught and performed at the Bayview Music Festival right here in northern Michigan. I'm Amanda Sewell, and Ergene Kang joins us now from the studios of KUAF Public Radio to discuss her latest album, the world premiere performances of not one but two violin concertos by the American composer Florence Price. Ergene Kang, welcome to Interlochen Public Radio.
Thank you so much.
Now, you're quite a presence in classical music there in the state of Arkansas, but you occasionally come here to northern Michigan. Tell us about your relationship with the Bayview Music Festival.
I may be incorrect on some of the dates, but I believe I was at Bayview from 2013 to 2015. And I worked with the Faculty String Quartet. As you may be familiar, it's a festival with vocal students, string students, and there's lots of chamber music. And part of the great, you know, feature of being in a summer festival is that faculty and students get to work together in a new environment, working on new and old pieces together. And it's just an added perk, as superficial as it may sound, to be inspired by such beauty. It was my first time in northern Michigan, and many people who had been there had been telling me that it was just going to be absolutely gorgeous. And to be honest with you, being from California, I sort of thought that, you know, you've got the beautiful ocean and the vistas. And so I wasn't too impressed by all of these verbal renditions of how beautiful it would be. And then I arrived, and as you can imagine, I just absolutely fell in love with it. And I still think about these beautiful sunsets and vistas. It never gets old. And I definitely replay it in my memory many, many times.
Well, let's chat about this new album you have. It features not one but two violin concertos by the American composer Florence Price. Tell us how these scores resurfaced after being lost for so many years.
So our library, the University of Arkansas Special Collections, holds all of Florence Price's manuscripts that we know of. And we received these manuscripts basically in two stages. There was a large bulk that was donated to us in the late 70s. And the second installment, I think, was closer to about 2009, 2010. And that was sold to us by a couple who came to purchase Florence Price's abandoned home in Chicago. And it seems almost cinematic, perhaps, but from all accounts, they purchased the home, and it had been abandoned for many years. And vandals had basically, of course, tried to take whatever they thought was valuable. Her piano, for example, was stolen, and I'm not sure if it was ever recovered. And the correspondence and papers and all of that were sort of all strewn across the floor. And our archivists and librarians came to purchase these papers because the couple who came to purchase the home did a little bit of internet research and sort of thought, these might be valuable. And so the remarkable thing to me is just that decision alone, even. To be honest with you, I could imagine a completely different scenario, which seems much more practical, which is you purchase a home, it's, you know, in disarray. You are kind of anxious, I would imagine, to get it into order quite quickly. And you see these loose leaf papers, you know, it'd be more likely, I would think, to just toss them in the trash. And so within these papers were the pieces of both concertos. And what was remarkable is that despite the parts, for example, being with the second concerto being in process. She had kind of written out a second violin part, for example, and maybe a wind part, but she hadn't quite finished all of the performable parts. The parts themselves are quite clean. She had drafts, and the drafts themselves were quite clean. So who knows if perhaps she had already kind of worked it out in her mind, or if there were many sketches that she had put together, and the manuscripts that exist that are in our hands are in fact, you know, the fifth or sixth rendition that she had worked out. Two versions of the second violin concerto exist, but there are very, very different small changes between the two.
So how do you get to be the person who would be the soloist in the world premiere recordings of these pieces?
Really, pure chance, I believe. the University of Arkansas held a Florence Price Symposium around, again, 2012 or so. I'm kind of fuzzy on the dates now, but it was a project that one of my colleagues, Jim Greason, had proposed for February. We have a Black Music Symposium every year, and that particular year he was interested in focusing primarily on Florence Price and wanted to display kind of the full palette of her compositions, both early and late, new and known, and of course vocal, pianistic, and string chamber music. And so he, of course, was in talks with many people, many colleagues, and for the string chamber music, he basically tried to stitch together a program that would be interesting and compelling, but also obviously would fit in with the program. It was about a three-day symposium. And to be honest with you, I had never heard of Florence Price before that point in time. And although discovering something new is always kind of the pleasure of being in teaching and being a musician, a lifelong learner, there's always also that embarrassment of, you know, I really should know this, but I don't, and why don't I know this? And so there was a little bit of fascination and pleasure and a little bit of aggravation, too, on my part, especially when I came to know that that she was actually William Grant Still's classmate, just the proximity of that. It aggravated me enough that I wanted to know more. And so he programmed two, three different chamber works of hers. We performed the piano quintet, we performed the earlier string quartet, and we performed one of her more modern string quartets, even though it was only written actually a few years after the more traditionally harmonized G major string quartet. And after performing these works, performing it, of course, gives you another layer of familiarity. You can read biographical accounts. And I think another thing that was quite interesting to me is the sentiment that I think is now widely expressed, which is she's often a figure who is talked about and you read about her, but you don't necessarily hear her music. And so for me, it was that very real experience of reading about her and feeling like I had known her as biographically as possible, but then being able to rehearse the music and perform the music, of course, was just another layer that piqued my curiosity and interest. Jim had been in the process of trying to make the documentary on Florence Price and asked me on one of these occasions to go down to Special Collections with him. I had expressed some interest in looking at her manuscripts, and so we went down there together. And it was, as you can imagine, one of these more loosely structured experiences where we're looking through boxes together, and it hadn't quite been categorized and cataloged yet. And so we weren't really sure what we were looking for. It was more just, okay, here are some boxes, let's just see what we find. And I would say the conversation while we were kind of leafing through these things was very much analogous to that kind of experience where he kind of talked about Florence Price's life and some of the biographies that he was reading, but he also talked about some of the novels that he was reading which had nothing to do with Florence Price. And so in this kind of exploratory conversation, he also said, oh, you know, she also has two violin concertos. And I said, I didn't realize that because, of course, her training being an organ and piano, and knowing a lot of her works in spirituals, I just came to assume that she wasn't that interested in string music. So it was one of these "oh really" moments, you know,
you
an exclamation
say.
next to the brain, exactly. And of course, I sort of thought, I wonder what it sounds like. And our training as violinists, of course, is always, well, did you consult a recording before coming to the lesson? That was always the level of preparation that was expected. Or have you, you know, thoroughly studied the score and, you know, consulted different recordings for interpretations? And so that was kind of my knee-jerk set of questions as well, which is, have these been recorded? When were they performed? And to my surprise, he said, well, the second violin concerto there was an account of its performance at the Florence B. Price Elementary School, but historians had not known where the manuscript was until recently in the second acquisition. So it has not been recorded. And that was amazing to me. And then in the same breath, he sort of said, maybe you should record them.
Maybe I should.
So, like I say, I wish it were a more, an answer of with more conviction, where there was, something more concrete. But it was very much a product of an exploratory conversation. And to be honest with you, after that conversation, I immediately rejected the idea. And it took me many months afterwards to come to the idea. And even then, I, you know, sort of had doubts of my abilities and of my credentials. You know, it's an interesting series of reflective moments, I think, for a performer when taking on a new work. I think there's always the question of who is the right person, which then, you know, for me at least, brings again another set of exploratory questions, which is, what does it mean to be the right person? What are the credentials that people expect? What are the credentials that I would expect of myself? What does it mean to have, quote, as much of an authentic voice to bring other than just capability? I think the capability question often is much more easy to answer than sort of the identity question. You know, the capability question being, can I play the right notes in a way with a beautiful sound that shows that I have training on violin in a way that commands a certain kind of legitimacy and credibility just as a player, as a technician, and also as an interpreter. But then I think there's all these other, I don't know what you would call them, just sort of as if you were in a concentric circle, kind of exploring outward all of the ramifications and consequences of what recording the first rendition of this concerto would mean, and who is the right person to do it, and what does it mean to take the first right step, and how is that done respectfully? I don't know. I think I maybe overthought the whole process, but to be honest with you, those were all of the questions that popped into my mind when I encountered this manuscript.
Well, let's talk about the recording that you've made. Let's start with the first concerto, the Violin Concerto No. 1 in D major of Florence Price. Let's listen to a movement from this. Which movement should we listen to?
I think the first movement is a good starting point. I think what's really interesting for a lot of musicians is how similarly it's modeled to the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. I mean, it's in D major. It's in three movements. It even has that cadential opening with the semitone A to B flat, and then it kind of has a flurry of it before it kind of goes into the first theme. So there's definitely lots of allusions there for sure. It goes then into a first theme, however, I think that very much is Florence Price, and that's not to say what precedes that is not, but I think if anyone were to say, this is so closely aligned with Tchaikovsky, the first theme definitely is the path of divergence from there. It's very folk-like. It's certainly very lyrical, just like Tchaikovsky's, but I would say it does not sound like Tchaikovsky from the first theme onward. The second theme, similarly, I would say, has a very... I hesitate to put labels on it, but I guess for simplicity, to me, a very American folk flavor to it. Some of the sort of chromatic, bluesy harmonies there, but it's still enfolded so nicely in a classical theme. It just, again, to me is amazing how much she integrates both her personal voice and pays deference to an expected traditional concerto theme.
Great. Well, let's listen to the first movement of the Violin Concerto No. 1 in D major of Florence Price, the world premiere recording featuring violinist Erjean Kang.
Thank you. Thank you.
Heard the first movement of the Violin Concerto No. 1 in D major of Florence Price. Ryan Cockerham conducting the Yanacek Philharmonic and featuring violinist Eugene Kong. This is the world premiere recording of the two violin concertos of Florence Price. And we're joined by Eugene Kong to talk about this new album. So, you've talked a lot about having the right credentials and being the one to do justice to the first recording of a piece of music. How did you sort of come to terms with being the first person to record this piece?
I think eventually, well, at least for me personally speaking, those questions never really go away. If anything, I feel they become even more present. And the call to refine that thinking process, possibly just my contribution, comes out in relief even more. But you learn to be okay with those questions. So for me, I started off the process hoping and wishing for some kind of resolution for those questions in some nicely packaged answer where, I guess in my fantasies, I sort of thought that somehow I would come to terms emotionally with being the first one and being okay with it. But, and I think on some level I am, but it's not quite what I expected it to feel like emotionally. I still feel that I've only begun to discover Florence Price. And I have these wishes, I think, that all performers do, which is if I had another chance to do this recording, I think I could do it even better. And so I just hope that this is, like many things, just a snapshot of where I was at the time with my best efforts, and that I know that I brought my most sincere and best efforts to the table when the recording button was set, and that I will have more opportunities to perform more of her music, and of course more of her concertos. The more I perform it, the more I think about it. I come up with new ideas about things that I feel I kind of missed the first time around.
Is it the pressure that you feel? Is it just because this is the first recording of a piece ever made, or is there an added layer because it's Florence Price, who is not only a woman but also an African American woman, and does that factor in as well?
Yes, I would say in an interesting way, as you were asking me the question, I thought both and neither, in a way. Maybe it's neither because they're both, or maybe it's both and therefore it's neither. But I think my feelings of, you know, my musical imperative is more generalized. And of course, it hinges on these specificities. But I would say specifically, just knowing how she's been overlooked, to me, furthers my efforts to make sure that, you know, that I'm not in some subconscious or negligent way contributing to that overlooking, which, I don't know, maybe that sounds strange because here I am trying to endeavor to bring her to light by recording it. But, you know, even in the recording process, if it were done, let's say, in a sloppy manner, I'm not sure if such a recording, if it existed, would be a net positive historically. And so for me, it's just making sure that as a performer, even though I realize I'm just one small cog in the conversation, that it's a cog that moves the conversation forward and brings the important issues to light. And certainly that it's not misrepresented either. So I think it's taking the role of the performer, for me, very seriously. But then also to realize that you don't want to be in a situation where there's no recording at all because nobody feels that they're able to answer to these imperatives, I suppose.
And I wanted to ask too, like, it's interesting because this recording has not only put Florence Price in the spotlight, but it's also put you in the spotlight. I mean, it's been featured in the New York Times and the New Yorker. And so were you anticipating this kind of attention?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. In fact, what I feel is interesting just on a purely performative end is my training, like many musicians, many violinists, was very, very traditional in the sense that I felt that I was only singularly trained and focused on playing the canonized works very well. And there was very little room for interpretation because the framework for what was considered acceptable and in the canon was so strict. And I think the idea, like many traditional classical training in all fields, is you learn the basics and then you find your voice post-school, let's say. You know, the teacher or the mentors at that point in time are, especially with violin, I would say, just because it's such a long process to even craft a beautiful sound out of the instrument and then, you know, to feel physically comfortable with the instrument. You're spending hours and hours just trying to get a nice sound on traditional repertoire. And so these sort of conversations that I find myself in now, I never anticipated it. I always grew up with the idea that people would just want to hear these classics, the Tchaikovsky's and the Brahms and the Sibelius and the Beethoven concertos. And, you know, it was adventuresome maybe to program some 20th century American composers, like John Adams or Philip Glass violin concerto or something, but not Florence Price. So I assumed that this was basically scholarly interest, to be honest with you, and that maybe people in Arkansas would be interested and basically say, hey, that's cool, and the end. And maybe some violinists who are particularly interested in, I guess, what would be considered non-traditional repertoire might be interested, but only because it's non-traditional, not necessarily because it's Florence Price. And I honestly just thought maybe my department would think that that was kind of interesting, and maybe the library would think that that was sort of interesting. So to have this kind of national attention was definitely, to answer your question in a very long-winded manner, it was definitely not anticipated at all.
Are you being contacted by other violinists who are wanting to perform this rep now?
Yes, absolutely. And I think what has been kind of a beautiful, for me, experience is those conversations, while they stem from a very practical initiative in the beginning, which is, how can I get this music? And, you know, how much...
Oh, right, because it's still in manuscript, isn't it?
Exactly. And how do I... You know, what's the rental fee? You know, it starts from a very, you know, nuts and bolts kind of conversation. But then sometimes they very much blossom into what I would categorize as my overthinking kinds of conversations, which is, what does this mean for you? And you know, oftentimes it's not that I'm in interviewer mode. It's often a conversation that organically stems from a shared interest, obviously, in this repertoire. So it only, I think, is a matter of time with certain performers who are more curious about the music for its cultural significance, what it signifies, what it could signify moving forward, what they hope it might symbolize, and what their contributions might be. As you can imagine, it's a multifaceted endeavor and a process. And the whole execution conversation of, how do I get the music? Where do I perform it? How do I play the notes? I mean, that's just... you know, 1% or so of the conversation. And what has been amazing to me is realizing how vast, in fact, the conversations can go. And it's surprising for me just because, again, I start from the assumption that this is very much a niche interest, and therefore I assume that it's actually quite small. But the more I talk to people, the more I realize it's possible that many people have just been working in their own corners and just haven't had the outlets to connect with one another. I've connected with people in Asia and England, for example, and in continental Europe, which I think many of the violinists and musicians and artists didn't have the awareness that there was other interests internationally. So it's always this coming together moment that is quite empowering. And the other aspect is just that oftentimes we have threads of thoughts and conversations in our own minds, or, you know, things that have happened in the past that lay dormant and are kind of at that subconscious level. And sometimes it takes maybe another conversation or, you know, reading something to bring that to the fore. And so I've also had many conversations with musicians who weren't necessarily directly pursuing something like this in their research interests or in their repertoire, but have been inspired to do so because that seed was already there. But, you know, there are things in life that kind of create that impetus. And for some people, it was just, you know, the Florence Price concertos, which is wonderful.
Well, let's listen to the other violin concerto that is on this album, the Violin Concerto No. 2 of Florence Price. What should we listen for in this recording of the piece?
So for me, I love how the two concerti are parallel, even though they're written, you know, decades apart. And I think for sure the second one shows a lot more confidence and exploration and desire to explore harmonically unstable territory. But at the same time, I would say it still holds that traditional concerto form despite being a single movement. It starts out with, again, a kind of cadenza that introduces the soloist. Again, it's in D major. Again, it kind of starts on a low A, and then kind of has this ascending cadential figuration that then opens up to the first theme, let's say. This particular concerto juggles only two themes, and so it could be considered a double variation, for example. And so to me, I also find that a very fun form to experiment with. And for me, as I started to think more about the second concerto, for example, I came to my own interpretive conclusions that the second theme, again, especially being in a distant key from D major, it goes through different themes, different keys. But each time it appears, to me, it represents kind of a dream deferred because of the way in which it is so gorgeously lyrical. And to me, it's very much a sign of hope and optimism that this dream, this distant dream, despite the fact that it's distant, for me at least, doesn't have this, let's say, squashed quality or deflated quality of a dream. It's very much in full bloom and it blossoms out and is able to express an image or evoke a concept of beauty that is very hopeful. And again, that appears somewhere a third or so around after she explores kind of this first theme, which I would say, again, has something that's quite quintessentially Florence Price. She has some experimental harmonies. She kind of plays around with, for me, a march-like theme that's very far from a march. It's kind of these dotted rhythms that are very lyrical. So there's a lot of both tipping of the hat and allusions, but also insertions of her own voice. And as a performer, it's always more fun to explore the cracks and the in-betweens of things rather than sort of the bookends or the solid states of musical themes.
Well, here is the Violin Concerto No. 2 in D major of Florence Price, the world premiere recording featuring our guest, violinist Eugene Kong, and the Janáček Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Ryan Cockerham.
Thank you.
the Violin Concerto No. 2 by Florence Price, the world premiere recording. Ryan Cockerham conducted the Janáček Philharmonic Orchestra, and the violinist was Erjean Kang. Erjean, thank you so much for joining us today here at Interlaken Public Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
The new album on Albany Records features the world premiere recordings of two violin concertos by Florence Price. You can read more about it on our website at classicalipr.org. Thank you to Timothy Dennis at KUAF Public Radio. I'm Amanda Sewell. Thanks for listening.